Joining me in the studio now, Michael Tavares, environmentalist, well-known islander, known, I suppose, for the one high-profile environmental protest of a few years ago in which Michael climbed a threatened kauri tree in West Auckland. How many days were you up there?
4.5 days.
4.5 days. Michael Tavares, welcome to Waiheke Radio, and thank you so much for giving us time on Saturday morning to come and talk through some issues.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, you're known, I guess, across New Zealand and particularly on Waiheke for that, you know, extraordinary and courageous protest. But you do a lot more than climb trees. And one of the reasons I was really keen to get you in here this morning on Waiheke Radio was to talk about this idea of yours of becoming a New Zealander. And for listeners who don't know, Michael's originally from Australia. And
sorry.
No need to apologise. It's clear that you're one of those Australians who thinks it's better over here. Now, before we go there, Tasmania?
Grew up in Sydney and lived for a couple of years in Tasmania. That's where I learnt to climb trees because there were rainforests being logged for toilet paper. So I picked up my tree climbing skills there.
Yeah.
Came over here to get away from that, live a nice, quiet, peaceful life. But then, you know, history happened.
So you were involved in those kind of forestry protection initiatives in Tassie, and then you came here for a quieter life but realised that you'd brought your passion with you, right?
The thing that two things drew me to New Zealand. The first was the fact that I could come on a one-way ticket. That was definitely one. And the other was that I heard there was a law over here that native trees were protected. So I'd heard that if I came over here, I could relax knowing that the forests, the wilderness was safe. It may not have been completely true, but that's what drew me over here, and that's why I thought I could relax.
I think that's the thing about the RMA. Hey, it sort of looks, it's effects-based, so it looks good, but actually when the effects can be argued to be less than significant, then people get away with stuff, right? So were you disappointed that when you came over here, actually kauri were being, I mean, significant kauri, this wasn't 12 foot tall. Were you disappointed that significant kauri were in fact threatened?
Well, I arrived in 2011, and this incident with the kauri tree in West Auckland was in 2015. So for 4 years, I was involved with other things. Confident in my mind that nature was safe here.
Yeah.
So when I heard about this tree that was under threat, my first reaction was surprise, because I didn't think that would happen here. Mm. And I think that was the reaction that a lot of people had when they found out about the issue. The main response was, really? Really?
Yeah.
And so that's what drew me to climb up there, because I could. I had the skills.
You had the skills, yeah.
And, well, it seemed to make sense that someone had to, because that just couldn't be allowed to happen.
Yeah. Waiheke was an obvious choice for you?
I didn't choose it.
Okay.
I was staying...
It chose you.
Yeah, I was staying in the Coromandel. I bought a donker of a car and drove down to Hawke's Bay, lived in the back of a hatchback and picked apples and parked under bridges, you know, just made enough money to buy food and repair the car week to week. Went back to the Coromandel really unsure what to do. Almost gave up, thinking that I hadn't quite made it here or hadn't found a way to feed myself and, you know, not be reliant on others. And then someone in the Coromandel gave me a ticket that they weren't going to use.
Was that to Oropu?
It was, yes. Yeah. So I don't know how many people, but I'm one of the few that arrived at the other end.
At the other end. I've left at the other end, but I don't know how many people have actually come to Waiheke for the first time from Coromandel to Oropu.
My first night on the island, I got off the ferry at Oropu. I had no maps. I had no bearings. I just followed the road, walked for a couple of hours, realised there was no settlements, slept on the side of the road, jumped a fence, slept on the side of the road, and was woken up by llamas. So it was an interesting introduction.
Yeah. Some fancy farm down there had llamas, did they? I bet that wasn't what you were expecting.
Well, you know, you just got to roll with it. But I walked in and I hitched the rest of the way, made it to the Saturday markets, met someone who wanted a woofer, stayed in their garage for a couple of weeks. My plan was to stay here for 2 weeks, and here I am 7 years later applying for citizenship.
Were you on your own? We'll come to citizenship in a sec, but no. Were you on your own then? Before we came on air, you talked about your wife, and so you've got married while you're here, have you?
Yeah, yeah.
Is she a Kiwi?
She is, yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, good choice. Hey, So you came over, you sort of settled down, and now you're kind of active in green politics here, and quite active in the Green Party.
Yeah.
Member, campaigner. Let's deal with this. Are you becoming a New Zealand citizen so you can stand for Parliament?
Well, that standing for Parliament would be one of the very few things that I currently can't do as a non-citizen and could do as a citizen. So that's one of the very few things. In fact, New Zealand's quite generous in allowing residents almost all of the rights of a citizen.
Yeah.
I've been voting here since 2014, whereas New Zealanders living in Australia for 20, 30, 40 years don't vote over there.
So. No, they don't vote. They don't get social welfare. They only have to fart in public and then they're suddenly on Manus Island. No, that's not fair. That's not fair. But let's bring Manus Island up while we can, while we've got Aussie in the studio. No, that's brought you to where you are now. You're going to apply for citizenship.
I have applied and it's been approved.
You have applied and it's been approved. Sorry. Yeah. So you just have the process of the formalisation of that citizenship to go through. Now, I texted a mate this morning to see if I could find out what he did to avoid swearing allegiance to the Queen. Not that, you know, there's necessarily anything wrong with that, but some of us don't want to do that when we become New Zealanders, and I know that this mate of mine was in the same situation. I haven't heard back from him because I understood that he could get away with that. Now, what's your view on this?
Citizenship's a funny thing that people don't really think about day to day or think about maybe at all until they think about changing it. And I think that when you think about citizenship and oaths and allegiances and all of those things, it's all built on a whole lot of assumptions, you know, an assumption in the legitimacy of a nation state and the assumption in the legitimacy of a crown, of a document, the authority of a mayor at a town hall to say you're a citizen and then you become one through this particular ritual. So I think a good place to start would be the assumption and the understanding that I start from and that I start from, and this is the understanding I've come to over 7 years of living here and talking to people. As best as I can read it, Māori are sovereign in this country.
Kia ora.
And none of that was ever given away. And it was those sovereign Māori who made an agreement with the Crown. And it is through that agreement that I'm even allowed to be here.
Indeed, and me too. And this is why I have always honoured and treasured the treaty as something very precious, because without it, I really am an intruder.
I think we're on the same page with that. I was also born under the same but different crown in Australia.
Yeah.
And so whilst it's very outdated, the treaty and the crown go together, I see. And so declaring my affirmation, I am joining in with that side of the treaty relationship. And that's how I see it, and that's how I'm going to do it.
So have you had confirmation that this is okay, that you can do this in a regulatory sense?
I will be doing the affirmation as presented, so I won't be deviating from the standard form.
Right.
I will be doing it in Te Reo Māori, which is an option that's become available over the last couple of years. So whilst I will be saying I bear allegiance to Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and successors according to law, I'll be saying that. What I'm really doing is throwing my lot in with Tangata Tiriti, the people who are here by right of that agreement, and it is that agreement that's paramount.
Yeah. So in a sense, when you swear allegiance to the treaty, you're swearing allegiance to both sides of the treaty?
I say so. It's
I kind of like that idea, because if you swear to the crown, you're kind of siding with the with the bigger party to the treaty. And there's an international law that says if there's a dispute over a treaty, it's the smaller, less powerful party whose version is considered. Therefore, the disagreement over the two versions of Te Tiriti is in fact, that disagreement means the Māori side in international law is the correct side. So to me, it's much better to swear allegiance to what is the, internationally recognised version of the treaty.
Yeah, well, I think we're on the same page there. I disregard comments about there being two versions. There is the one that was agreed to, and it is the one that you say recognised by international law.
Yeah, that's right. I can't remember. I can't remember the. There's a name for the international principle, the principle of international law.
Our lawyer friends will be able to tell us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, thank God we have lawyer friends and don't have to be lawyers. Yeah, so we have Michael Tavares in the studio up here at Waiheke Radio. Michael, of course, the well-known environmentalist, and we're talking to him about a variety of things, including his successful application for New Zealand citizenship. So congratulations on that. That's, you know, better to be a Kiwi than not be a Kiwi.
Yeah, it like I said before, people don't think much of it, but this is of their citizenship until it's... They're thinking of changing it.
Yeah.
But every time I leave this country for a holiday, when I come back through the gates, I'm reminded that I'm not of this place. And so going through this ceremony and being welcomed in will be a change of state for me.
You can keep both passports, can you?
I can, yeah, and yeah. I will.
So you're a sort of Oz-Kiwi.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. So, all right, well, let's... Michael's actually taken some hours off work to come up here today, so appreciate that. Won't keep you much longer, but would like to ask you about the 12 years that the UN has announced we have. Well, I mean, one UN report released a couple of weeks ago has made it pretty clear we have about 12 years to make significant reductions in carbon emissions, or else climate change will become unmanageable and more, I guess, ultimately catastrophic rather than just disastrous, if you can make a distinction between those two things. What can we do here on Waiheke about this?
Yeah, so just when that song was playing, you were telling me about your brother telling you in 1978.
1978, my brother, who was a science student at the time, I was a 14-something-year-old panicking about nuclear war, the threat in the Cold War, and my brother, who was a science student, said, no, don't worry about nuclear bombs, bro, there's this thing called greenhouse gases. Mm. Why has it taken so long for this to become a political compulsion?
You might have to speak to a sociologist about how we're able to recognise some threats more readily than other threats. You're telling me a story about your brother reminded me that in growing up in Australia in the 80s and 90s, our good teachers were telling us about the fact that if we didn't do something, the Great Barrier Reef would start to bleach. And now there are enormous sections of it that are completely white. Almost
absolutely
dead,
tragic,
and in danger of losing the World Heritage status because of its degraded state. I just wonder if we're being told we've got 12 years now. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we were being told the same thing, and yet nothing's happened in that time. So there's got to be something in our psychology about not recognizing something until it's too late on a scale like that. As well as the fact that a lot of climate denialism seems to be psychologically based rather than evidence, the problem becomes so big, so we'd rather pretend that it isn't there.
You're very generous. I'm much more inclined to put selfish profiteering down as the reason we're refusing to do anything about it.
Yeah, I think you're right there too. It depends on the we. So we're talking about, you know, our relatives who just want to close their ears to it. They're the ones I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay.
And then when we're talking about those with the power, those with the money, those with the political power, well, in our democracies, we tend to think in 2, 3, or 4 year terms. So that's climate change is a problem for the next government. It's always a problem for the future, and historically it has been. And often the political price of doing action now can cost you that next election. So there's been a lot of timidity on that front.
Are you a bit more confident with this government about that? They do seem to be prepared to take a political risk or two.
Yeah, it's the best chance we've had ever. So the fact that we've got the Green Party with ministers
and Minister of Conservation.
Yeah, and able to...
Environment.
Yep, and land information and associate conservation. What I've been... I mean, I'm as you've mentioned, I'm involved with the Green Party, and one thing that we've learned as a party through our ministers is that it's actually the soft power. So our Green Party ministers, in conversation with Labor and NZ First ministers, are able to get in their ears and in a way that numbers on the floor or petitions and things might not do. So. That's happening, but you just wonder if that might be too slow and if we needed to have maybe done this 20, 30, 40 years ago. So I'm of the view that we do everything. So we should not put all our eggs in, you know, bioengineering, those people that want to shoot iron into the clouds or, you know, all of these things.
There were these sort of conspiracy theories 20 years ago or 10 years ago about putting barium in the clouds or whatever to reflect the sun back out. And then lo and behold, 10 years later, they're actually discussing it. That's kind of crazy, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a scientist, but I'm of the view that we should be doing everything and everything. It's obvious that the world needs to change its energy production, transport, and agriculture systems, and it's clear to everyone that we need to decouple rising in standards of livings from carbon emissions, because one of the fear tactics that the opponents of action say is that we would wish for everyone to live like medieval peasants or go and live in caves in hair shirts. Yeah. We can have a raised standard of living decoupled from carbon emissions. But, you know, this extinction movement that's doing protests all over the world and calling on government to act, and not just government, all of society to act. And I don't think they're too over the top in naming their movement Extinction, because we know humanity can come together. You know, during the Second World War, and yes, referring to what I said earlier, the threat was obvious and it had a face.
Yeah.
But we were able to band together and turn all of our industry, all of our science, all of our efforts globally to a focused action. Well, it's that level of focus that's needed now. How that's going to happen, whether that's going to happen, well, it's not going to happen from the top. And so...
I'd like to make a point there, which it wasn't George Monbiot, it was some other anti-neoliberalism writer in The Guardian recently said, we've been fooled into fighting climate change at an individual level, you know, recycling and going vegan. And I don't think he was saying any of those things were bad things to do in any way. Mm-hmm. But really, that had kept our focus at our own compost bin and not turning us collectively to fight the powers, the corporate power that is responsible for climate change. I mean, there was an extraordinary interview yesterday on RNZ with the foreign minister of Vanuatu, and Vanuatu wants to lead a legal challenge against the world's 90 companies or corporations that create two-thirds of carbon emissions. Now, when you can put two-thirds of carbon emissions and tie those to 90 corporations, that almost seems manageable at a revolt level.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's that comes back to what you were going to ask me about, what we can do at an island level.
Yeah, all right.
And I mean, I drive a Leaf, but I didn't do that for greenie points. I did that to get out of paying for petrol. And I compost, and I do that so that I can grow food. But if everyone did everything at an individual level, the systems of power that hold everything back, comrade, they're still there.
Yeah.
The US military is the world's single largest polluter, and two-thirds of the emissions, as you say, are attributable to companies with directors and boards that we can name.
Tangible. Yeah, it's tangible.
So you say, what can Waiheke do? Well, Waiheke is to this country what this country is to the world. A small little bit on the side that is noisy and can make things happen. So this was what, the nuclear-free island that pushed for a nuclear-free country. So...
And initially GE free, we declared ourselves GE free, and then perhaps the heat went off the GE issue. Mm-hmm. But particularly with the Royal Commission of Inquiry, with their sort of proceed with caution decision. So to wrap up, are you hopeful? You're a positive dude.
Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful. I think that a good amount of climate change is now inevitable.
Yeah,
and by 2100, we are looking at a different planet, and let's not gloss over the fact that it will hit those with the least the most.
Yeah,
and so we have a responsibility as the global north, even though we're here at the bottom of the world, as the global north to deal with the inequality and the displacement, and you know, pay our share and look after people.
Mm.
So I'd see a rising, particularly in people my age and younger, concern for broader things than, you know, broad, despite talking about citizenship, for transnational compassion and kindness and a solution for all.
And so global solutions, not just global trade.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. Michael Tavares, that's a great place to finish. I really appreciate your time this morning. What can I say except thank you for coming in, sharing your wisdom and your passion, and all the best, and we'll talk to you again soon.